And now, with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved, here is Dr. James Houck.
Good evening, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. In fact, finding one's courage to reclaim that which you have always been and always are. Very excited to be with you here tonight, every other Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and every other time in between, because each and every broadcast here focuses on the integration of our spirituality and our mental health, all within the larger context of our oneness with ourselves, others, and God, or the divine. I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me, or if you would like to leave me your comments about tonight's show, I invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That is all one word right there. And just in case you cannot spend the entire hour with me this evening, these broadcasts are podcasted now in case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. Just go on the website and find the archives button, click on that, and you can listen to any show that you may have missed. Well, as you've been following me for some time, I really appreciate your patronage, and I just thank you from the bottom of my heart. It's really really special to have this audience with me. And you know, if you've been following me for some time, that I often like to start these shows by just giving a breakdown of who I am and how I came to be, so to speak. And because there's always new people tuning in for the very first time, so I find that it's very helpful just to kind of lay the foundation, as it were. And just like to share with everybody that over the years, have just come to really embrace a very solid belief that all of us have come into this world already equipped and graced with everything that we need for in this life, in terms of our skills, our talents, our strengths, our giftedness, our character traits, personalities, and so forth, and how we live our giftedness is in and through various relationships. And this aspect is very important when considering who we are, because although we may have similar gifts or skills or talents or strengths or character traits, no two people express these identically. In other words, each of us have a this-ness about us that cannot be duplicated. So, you know, people can try and imitate how we do things, but no one person has the ability to be able to duplicate ours. Because within us lies what the 12th century scholar John Duns Scotus referred to as acheitas, a this-ness, a uniqueness, if you will. And as I explain it to kids and even teenagers and adults too, we get this analogy as well. It's like a thumbprint. You know, no two people have the same thumbprint, but everybody has a thumbprint. Okay, so we all have this uniqueness or thisness, this acheitas, but no two people have it the same way. Okay, and so tonight, I just wanted to really stress this uniqueness, this-ness, and just help everyone out there who is listening to move a little bit closer to their truth and discovering who they are and living in the fullness of who they are in and through relationships. Because there is a great importance of this realization of who we truly are, that I'm going to be sharing in three very familiar stories that illustrate this. So, welcome to the embodied soul, phenomenal cosmic powers, itty bitty living space. Well, unfortunately, millions of people, I've never had a chance to discover their uniqueness, let's say, because growing up, we're often told to look in all the wrong places. Look at what you're good at. Look at what you're not good at. Look at what you do. Look at what you don't do. Look at the approval of others. Don't look at the approval of others, and so on and so forth. Everything is external. And we were told to look for our thisness in the externals of life, or the accumulation of things, or accomplishments, or accolades. But this is not where our thisness, uniqueness, and hachaitas is to be found. Instead, the full expression of who we are is to be found within the deep realization and full experiences with ourselves as soul. And yet, it's kind of ironic when you think about it that we often receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, even spiritual wounds in these relationships. Because, we often go through life, sometimes we just mind our own business and we're in the wrong place at the wrong time. And maybe due to some unpleasant experiences, we may think that we need to hide our talents and our skills and our giftedness. Such as, we need or we feel the need to give up and give in to the labels and the stereotypes that others want us to be for them so that they feel good about themselves. Okay, that's very important. We often give up and give in to the labels and stereotypes that others want us to be for them so that they can feel good about themselves. Or there's other times when we may push our giftedness way down so that others cannot see it, because perhaps maybe we experienced ridicule or shame or bullying or something. And so whenever we displayed our giftedness or our skills and our uniqueness, it was ridiculed and it was exploited. Okay? Or so others seen it as a chance to bully, because they were unable to, let's say, bring out their uniqueness. And, it's also a strong possibility that we were told that we would have never amounted to anything, or whatever other voice we heard telling us that there's nothing special to us. And that is just plain wrong, because each and every one of us, each and every one of you out there is unique. You are special. And it is my deep, deep, deep intention that you come into the fullness of the awareness of just how unique and special you are. Because, and getting back to relationships and the woundedness that we quite often find in relationships, it is also ironic that these relationships, that we experience as deep woundedness just might be within our own families. They could just be amongst coworkers, it could be from institutions, it could be even with friends. And we assume that the people who are supposed to love us the most just might turn out to be the ones who hurt us because of their unhealed wounds and their underdeveloped selves. But still, all is not lost, because there is power in seeking healing and inner transformation, and the direct realization of ourselves as soul. Because when we transform, and there is power in this transformation, we also transform others by our presence, our grace, and understanding. And you and I both know that the way the world is today, we need this the most. The best thing we can do is work on ourselves and extend forgiveness, kindness, and compassion and really take a look at how we treat ourselves. Because whenever we are compassionate with others, we then become aware of the need to be more compassionate with somebody else. And when we are forgiving with ourselves, we then come into the realization that we can certainly be more forgiving with others. And when we're able to live in gratitude with ourselves, we then discover how this opens up our hearts to be able to see and live in gratitude with others. And trust me, gratitude is very catching. It is almost irresistible. When you live in gratitude and you extend that gratitude to others without expecting anything in return, people want to know where that comes from. People are touched by that. People are changed by that depth of gratitude. So when we are able to truly know ourselves as a soul and we live from our soul, it certainly opens us up to understand the potential in others, to see themselves as soul. So again, transformation, first and foremost, begins with us. And in a nutshell, this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about. It actually can be summed up in one word, namaste. You've heard that one before, namaste. Roughly translated, it means, because I see myself as a soul of light, this allows me to greet your lighted soul of who you are, even if you don't see it in yourself. How's that for an extended definition? Well, how is your heart today? I hope your heart is well, and I hope you are well. I hope that even if you are struggling today, you will be able to find rest, you'll be able to find comfort, and you'll be able to find the peace that you need. And again, if you've been listening to this show for some time, you may ask yourself, why do I always begin these sessions by asking people about their hearts? Well, there's a simple explanation for this. According to the researchers at the Heart Math Institute, the more, let's say, traditional ways of studying the communication pathways between the head and the heart has, often led scientists to focus primarily on the heart's response to the brain's instructions. In other words, the brain sends the signals to the heart, and then the heart does its job, even though the heart is an involuntary muscle. We don't have to tell that muscle, that heart, to beat. It just automatically does this, However, the people at the Heart Math Institute, they have now discovered that this communication between the heart and the brain is actually a very dynamic, ongoing, two-way dialogue, with each organ continuously influencing the other's function. In other words, the brain sends signals to the heart, and the heart sends signals to the brain. Because their research has shown that the heart communicates to the brain in four major ways. It communicates neurologically, such as through the transmission of nerve impulses. The heart also communicates to the brain biochemically via hormones and neurotransmitters like dopamine, serotonin, and so forth. And the heart also communicates to the brain biophysically, that is, through pressure waves. And finally, the heart also communicates to the brain energetically through electromagnetic field interactions. And you've heard me talk about energy many times on this broadcast, that there is no way that we can ever destroy energy, but we can transform it. And that works into transforming negative energy in our lives into something that is life-giving and very, very powerful. And communication along these channels, let's say neurologically, biochemically, biophysically, there you go, it's a tongue twister, and energetically, signifies it significantly affects the brain's activities. And moreover, the HeartMath researchers have shown that these messages the heart sends to the brain also affects performance. Go figure. So, listen to your hearts. They have a lot to say. Okay. Well, if you're a fan of Disney movies, which I am, and my favorite Disney movie is The Lion King, and I'll at some point ask me about it, and I'll tell you all about why it's my favorite Disney movie. But another favorite movie, and in fact, one of the more memorable scenes in the Disney movie Aladdin, is when the genie tries to describe to Aladdin, our boy, that being a genie isn't really all that it's cracked up to be. I mean, come on, you know the story. Aladdin at the beginning of the movie was banished into the Cave of Wonders only to discover this dust-covered lamp. I mean, like, what is this? It's just a lamp. And when Aladdin wipes it off and puts a shine, let's say, to it, out pops this genie who says that he will grant him three wishes, along with a nice little song and dance. Okay. Now, despite this awesomeness and the power to grant wishes, this genie appears to be sad, stating to Aladdin that, yes, he has phenomenal cosmic powers, but since he's tethered to his lamp, he's confined to an itty bitty living space. In other words, without the lamp, he cannot exist. That is, unless someone wishes for him to no longer be a genie. And that's, the rest of the story right there. Well, interestingly enough, this story of the genie, Aladdin, and the lamp reminds me of who we are as embodied souls. Yes, we are souls living in a body. But where I disagree with Aladdin is that although the genie is tethered to the lamp for his existence, we're not tethered to the body for ours. And we often forget this fact because we tend to place more of an emphasis on the physical than the soul. But the truth is that we are so much more than what we have become so far and have realized, and therefore we have yet to fully realize that we are eternal and vast. Now, yes, it's true. The body needs rest. The body needs food. The body needs water. The body needs exercise. And at times, the body needs medicine. But again, our true self is the soul, eternal, immeasurable, and without form. The body gives form to the formless soul, but the body is temporary, whereas the soul is eternal. And I've had teachers and friends explained that the embodied soul, using another great metaphor, they say, think of it this way. The next time a bottle is filled with water, or you have a soda, bottle, whatever. Another good example is understanding the embodied soul, because the bottle is the body, and the water, let's say, is the soul. The water doesn't need the bottle for its existence. Okay? I mean, we can get rid of the bottle, and we still have the water. Same analogy, when it is our time to pass from this earth, let's say, the body goes into the ground, or it goes into the flames. The soul lives on. It's not tethered to the body. And here's the irony in all of this. When we're able to truly see ourselves as soul, and ultimately when we are able to realize ourselves as soul, and we begin to see others as soul, we are no longer willing to accept relating to people as anything less than them also being souls. Well, there's another story out there that I have shared before with this audience, and it fits. So I'm going to share it again. It helps explain the false notion that we are limited. Okay, and it's the story of the washerman and the donkey. And those who have heard it before, it doesn't hurt to hear it again because it is a truth. And for those who are hearing it for the first time, I ask that it would just bear wonderful fruit in your life. Okay, the washerman and the donkey. Now, once upon a time, there was a man who lived hundreds of years ago. And being a simple man, his occupation was that of being a washerman, one who goes around and collects people's dirty laundry and loads them on his donkey. And then he takes them down to the river and he washes the laundry and then lays them out on large rocks to dry. And at the end of the day, when the laundry is dry, he then folds the laundry and he returns it to his customers. And he does this day in, day out, every day. Well, one day, when he was collecting the laundry and taking it down to the river to wash them, he realized that he had forgotten the rope to which he would tie the donkey to a tree so that it wouldn't run off while he was washing the laundry. Okay. And when he realized this, he was so beside himself because he would lose a whole day's wage if he had to go back home and get his rope. And he just didn't know what to do. And as he was standing there, not knowing what to do, a wise man walked by and asked if he was all right. And the washerman explained the situation to this man about forgetting his rope so he couldn't tie his donkey and he couldn't go back home and so on and so forth. And this wise man smiled and said, "Sir, no need to worry. I have an idea. Just pretend to tie the donkey to this tree." "Well, what do you mean, just pretend?" "Yes, just pretend to go through the motions of tying your donkey to the tree, only make sure he sees you do this." Well, as ridiculous as it sounded, the washerman did just that. He pretended to tie his donkey to the tree, making sure the donkey was watching him. And then he took his laundry down to the river and he began to wash it. And every now and then, the washerman would look back over his shoulder at the tree just to see what his donkey was doing. And the donkey was still there, eating grass and, just it acted like it's been tied to the tree all along. The donkey didn't move. Now, when he had finished his laundry for the day, he loaded up his donkey and now he commanded his donkey, "Okay, let's go. Let's go home." But the donkey did not move. In fact, it acted as if it had been tied to the tree all along. And now the washerman thought that he was really in a bind because he couldn't get his donkey to move. How's he going to return the laundry? How's he going to make any money? So he runs and he finds this wise man who told him to just pretend tying the donkey to the tree in the first place. Well, he found the man and he explained the situation that now the donkey refuses to move because it thinks it's still tied to the tree. And the man replied to the washerman that, "Well, that's okay, sir. No need to worry. There's an easy solution. Just as you pretended to tie the donkey to the tree, now I need you to pretend to untie the donkey from the tree. Only make sure the donkey watches you do this." So the washerman goes back to his donkey. He starts to pretend that he's untying the donkey, and he made sure that the donkey was watching him. Then, with a stern voice, he commanded the donkey to move, and he and the donkey started to walk back home. Well, on the surface, this story, we might think that the donkey in the story was just plain stupid. Being tricked into thinking that it was actually tied when it was in. Actually, not. Because when you think about it, all the washerman did was simply go through the motions of tying and untying his donkey which actually work. Now, my friends in India have often used this story to demonstrate how the Vedanta scriptures from which this story comes exemplifies classic human behavior. They say, every day we think that we're the body, we think that we're the mind and the intellect, and all of these things need to be nurtured. But a man is working day and night to meet these needs of the body, the mind, and the intellect, running after many temptations. And you know, he does this because he thinks that if he does not nurture his body, he will die. And he has put all of these restrictions around himself. And like the donkey, humanity thinks it's in this servitude. It thinks that it's tied to a tree, metaphorically speaking. It doesn't think it's free. In other words, humanity doesn't know that we are not the body, not the mind, not the intellect. We are independent of those things because we are soul. There are no restrictions on you, no bondages, and even if this body dies, the soul will not die. So the Vedanta scriptures tells humanity that the body and the soul are not one. They are different. And yet we're so limited in our understanding that we're bound by what we see or feel or hear or taste and touch, you know, through the five senses, that we think that, well, that's all there is. And we, like the donkey, end up believing this illusion that we are limited or restricted simply because we're told by another that we are. And unfortunately, we take on that as our identity, and we act accordingly, believing that, well, this is as good as it's going to get. And I see this quite a bit, this analogy quite a bit, in counseling people who identify themselves with their problems or their illnesses. They're not aware of being more than what they have become so far in life, and so they often accept this distorted template that has been laid over top of their lives. And as a result, people tend to beat themselves up or victimize themselves over and over again for making the same mistakes over and over again in the choices, the relationships, and throughout life. And yet, in the story, the donkey that is free the whole time thinks that it's tied. So on a metaphysical level, we who are souls believe we are tied to the body. Our soul is captive, and it seems to be the concrete truth. However, at the physical level, we are bound to an endless desire to acquire such things as beauty or spiritual experiences or knowledge or wealth and fame or success. Nothing wrong with these, as well as the enjoyment of these objects, as well as, well, I don't want to experience anything negative either. Okay, I'd rather not suffer. Thank you very much. And as a result, we believe that we have to find the key to our prison, you know, and that key, so to speak, could be, well, I just need to make more money. Or I need to have more freedom. I had to need more passion in my life, or I need to find true love, or any other desire. But what if we are already free? What if there's no rope, no tree? What if the illusion of being in prison is just an illusion? Now, I don't want to come across as one who minimizes another person's pain or problems or struggles. But how might we be empowered if we embraced ourselves and see ourselves as solutions to our problems by removing these layers of conditioning, or let's say the imaginary rope, that keep us tied to our problems? What keeps us bound to toxic relationships? What keeps us thinking that there's nothing more to us because we've been told such and such about ourselves all of our lives? Well, my teacher is often fond of saying that most people think that any undesirable situation is due to the behavior of others. In other words, People do not want to accept responsibility for their own thoughts and words and actions. And furthermore, perspective is clearly the result of the mind's doing. It's simply caused by the weakness of the mind and the absorption of negative thoughts. In other words, a lot of people keep themselves in victimhood. They use victim language. They have this perspective of like, I can't do anything because I'm a victim. I can't go anywhere. I can't do anything. I can't grow in my life because, well, I'm tied to the tree. And if you think you're weak, you become weak. And if you think you're a victim, then you will become a victim. And most people have accepted this inner weakness to the point that they are attached to it. They don't want to come out of their self-created illusions. And maybe by looking at ourselves more closely or examining our motives and examining our assumptions and limited perspectives, we just might realize the first step towards lasting transformation is to acknowledge first this illusion of oppression and that it's all in our minds. What are we believing? What do we think is true? Who told us that? And so forth. In other words, we might be in a physical prison, but if we find our true nature, that we are eternal souls, then no amount of earthly limitation can convince us that we are limited, inadequate, or restricted. Well, I really would love to hear what's on your heart about this subject. So if you would like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Hey, welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you're listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Well, welcome to this broadcast, The Embodied Soul, Phenomenal Cosmic Powers, Itty Bitty Living Space. And yes, I got this from the Disney movie Aladdin, because it fits what we are talking about tonight. Because earlier in the show, I was talking about a story that's often used to demonstrate how a donkey that is free all the time thinks that it's tied. And similarly, on a, let's say, a metaphysical level, we who are souls often believe that we are tied to the body, much in the same way that the genie in Aladdin was tethered to his lamp. We believe that we're tied to the body. We believe wrongly that our soul is captive, and that seems to be the concrete truth, and we just leave it at that. But on a physical level, you know, we may convince ourselves like, well, I guess I am bound to the body because I get up every morning, I go to work, I earn a paycheck or whatever, and that's because I need to acquire things such as beauty or knowledge or wealth or fame or success, or I need to have my needs met and so on and so forth, and I want to enjoy the things that I work hard for, as well as avoid the negative things in our lives, such as bad relationships, illness, financial problems, so on and so forth. Now, my India friends understand that people are already in a relationship with all things and all people, including God. That's where they come up with the term oneness. They are already one with all things. But many people don't know that yet. Therefore, it's a matter of realizing that we are souls that are vast and formless and eternal. And I've talked with my friends in India, and we have some pretty interesting conversations about sin and ignorance and so forth. And whereas others see sin as people who are bad or evil, they believe that people act out of ignorance, let's say, of who they are. In other words, they don't know what they're doing. They don't know who they are. They don't see how their actions and thoughts and words can be very destructive to others. And therefore, they commit evil acts because they have not realized themselves and others as souls. Because in Western spirituality, let's say, the concept of sin tells people that they are wrong, that they have done something wrong, and therefore they need to eliminate sin in order to be in a right relationship with God and others. And for us, regardless of religion, okay, it's a matter of understanding how we live our lives with these superimposed notions, or let's call them distorted templates, that we are nothing more than bodies and minds. And yes, we have bodies and minds, but we believe that's all there is to us. And that someday, if we're good enough, we'll get to go to heaven. Well, I've seen this in Christianity, that people are afraid to walk in the newness of life because they still believe they are tied to the tree, so to speak. Okay? They don't realize that they have incredible, phenomenal cosmic powers, and they think, well, I have to be in this itty-bitty living space. You know, they don't know that you're not tethered to the body. You're not tethered to the lamp, let's say. And this is what it means to move into, let's say, a higher spiritual dimension relationship with God. It's moving into this oneness. And yes, we have to contend with living in a three-dimensional world, but we are so limited where all we have to do is realize our freedom. What holds us back? What holds us down? What keeps us living in fear? What keeps us as victims? I mean, didn't Jesus even say that the kingdom of God is in you? We just haven't realized it yet. And even Jesus also said, you know, he says, you are the light of the world. And perhaps we just don't know how to embrace it, let alone walk in the newness of that life and that light and relationship. But just imagine what a difference it would make in our lives and even the lives of humanity if we see this illusion for what it is and we untie the limitations of this donkey mind, we dissolve the ignorance of who we are, and we walk in the freedom that has always been. That would literally turn the world on its head. You know, but as a result, we believe that we have to find some key to our prison. You know, the key could be, I just have to make more money, or I need deeper passions, or I have to find my true love, or anything else. You know, what if we're already free? What if we imagine that we are not really in a prison? You know, and I don't mean to belittle anyone's problems here, and I've often talked about solving our problems by removing the layers of conditioning here with these imaginary ropes that tie us to our problems. But we are so much more. And maybe looking at ourselves more closely, examining our motives and examining our assumptions and our perspectives, and just ask some very difficult questions of ourselves. Like, what keeps us bound to toxic relationships? whether it be on a personal or a professional level. What keeps us thinking that there's really nothing more to us because, well, that's all I heard as a child, and I just grew into believing it. You know, and herein lies this great lesson to be learned regarding recognizing who we are as souls. Because you see, on this level, there are illusions that have been superimposed that we all are just a particular body with a set of feelings and thoughts and taking in the external world around us. And let's face it, ours is a world whereby we are familiar with superimposed images all the time. Because basically, to superimpose something means to place or lay over or above something on another image. And photographers, they're familiar with this term, and they may even use this technique all the time for its special effects and so forth. And those who are familiar with music recordings, this is called overdubbing, which is also known as layering, which is a technique used in which audio tracks that have been pre-recorded are then played back and incorporated into another track. So, when we believe that there is nothing more to us than a body and mind, or let's say that we define ourselves according to our wounds and scars and experiences, negative experiences, we're reinforcing this template or this superimposition of this illusion that that's all that there is. Now, removing this illusion and realizing the underlying reality, let's say, is called de-superimposition. And one of my favorite stories is looking for the butter in every bowl of milk. And this particular story shows us that what we see isn't all there is. The story goes like this. There once lived a man who was quite rich. He was a very, very wealthy man. This man used to pray a lot. Every day he used to pray. Prayed in the morning. He prayed at mealtimes. Even at night, he used to pray. But one day, this thought comes into his mind, and he said, "You know, I pray to God. I always think about God. But where is God? Where does God live?" So he sent a message to all the people that if anybody can tell me where God is, I will give them 100 gold coins. Well, news like that got out in a hurry that this rich man was going to offer 100 gold coins to anybody who could tell him where God is. And everybody wanted to try and tell this man. You know, they would tell him, "Oh, I can tell you where God is. God is in the mountains. God is in the sky. God is in the heavens. God is in the sea. God is in far away countries." But these answers certainly weren't what the man was quite looking for. And then this elderly man came up to the rich man. He was a very quiet man. He was also a very wise man. Everybody knew him as a just, very calm and quiet and very humble person. And he said to the rich man, "Sir, I know where God is." And the wealthy man said, "Really? Please tell me, where is God?" Well, the wise man said, "Well, first, I just need you to bring me a bowl of milk." And the wealthy man was confused by this. It's like, okay, is this guy just thirsty? Or, you know, he didn't understand how that would help, but it seemed easy enough. So after the bowl of milk arrived, the wise man said, "Okay, now I want you to put your hand in the bowl of milk." So the rich man put his hand in the milk. And then the wise man asked him, "What's in the milk?" Well, you and I both can see that there's nothing in the milk. It's just a bowl of milk. So he asked him again, "Are you quite sure there's just milk in there?" "No," said the rich man. There's nothing in the milk. It's just a bowl of milk. So the wise man said, okay, I want you to stir the milk with your hand. And so he stirred the milk, and he stirred it, and he stirred it, and he stirred it. He stirred it for such a long time that he had to take a rest. And then after he rested, the rich man started to stir it again. And he stirred and stirred and stirred. And wow, would you believe it? From the same bowl of milk, there was cream. And then there was butter. These things came from the milk. The rich man looked at the wise man and said, okay, I don't understand. What is the point you're trying to make here? I ask you to tell me where God is, and you just give me a bowl of milk and tell me to stir it. Yes, I can see the cream, you know, rising to the top, and then it turned into butter. But what does this have to do with God? Where is God? Now, the wise man said, sir, God isn't far away. God is inside of you. And what we have to do is sometimes churn ourselves, our mind, our heart, our feelings, our soul. And when we do this, it's like the churning of the milk. Slowly, within time, we see that God is inside of us, that we are always connected to God. Just like the butter is inside the milk, God is inside of us, the soul. Well, the rich man, when he thought about it, he fell to his knees and he bowed to the wise man and he said, tell me, who taught you these things? And the wise man got a twinkle in his eyes and he said, well, sir, many a wise people have realized this. God isn't far away. God isn't just in the skies or the heavens, but God is very close to us. Now, this story reminds us of how important it is to see the divine or see God in everyone. Okay, that calls us back to be reminded of exactly what Namaste is talking about. Because I can see the light within myself, that enables me to be able to see the light in you. And when you're able to see the light in yourself and that you are light, you're able to see the light in others, and so forth, and so forth. And how we begin to treat one another is going to change. Okay? But we believe that maybe perhaps in order to see God, we must first make God conform to our vision or our philosophy or even our worldview. Or maybe we believe that God can be captured in the externals, that if we just polish up the outside, okay, getting back to Aladdin and his lamp, then God can be found in the aesthetics of people, places, and things. Now, the danger of this is that when we are so focused on the external, we cannot see the soul of another person, let alone butter, inside every gallon of milk. And through this simple children's story, you know, we learn that perhaps, okay, maybe we have been looking for God in all the wrong places, but God can be found in the everyday ordinariness of life. Well, some people might argue God simply cannot be found in the ordinariness. Or can he? You know, this opens up for us a profound understanding of who we are as souls. We look at each other as souls, and we soon discover we see that ourselves are souls, and vice versa, and vice versa. We begin to realize the externals don't really matter. And when we're able to do this, the isms of the world start to crumble. You know, there's no more sexism. There's no more racism. There are no more isms, ageism and such, because these isms simply cannot abide holding up to the standards that we are all souls and that we are all children of light. And so Let's take this a little bit deeper. Why do we have the externals? And why are we here on earth as an embodied soul? Some people would say that we're an embodied soul because of the karma that we still need to work out, that the soul still needs to work out in terms of the lessons that are learned and healing that needs to take place. And we're often reminded of the wounds and the habits or the choices or whatever that we make is how we're working out that karma. And if these things come to us through the externals, you know, such as, you know, illnesses or whatever, or other experiences and whatever other lessons there are for us to learn the deeper meanings. And again, was Christ who said the pure in heart shall see God? And how do we purify our hearts? Through relationships, of course. But, you know, you may ask, how am I going to be able to pure my heart in relationships when all I've known is betrayal, hurt, rejection, and pain in relationships? And these are legitimate questions, ones in which need to be addressed in the here and now. You see, what it means for us to live our interpersonal relationships is living with one another and to seek and ask for forgiveness. And certainly seeing the invisible God in much in the same way in which we see the butter in every bowl or gallon of milk. You know, many times we are guilty of asking God to give us a sign so that we may believe. Show us something. Prove to us that you are there. Now, you know, all throughout history, people have wanted to see God, and yet God was standing right in front of them all along. I mean, God was standing in front of us, let's say, in the form of simple kindness. You know, a simple cup of cold water on a hot day or a cup of a hot drink on a cold day. A meal. Certainly God was there. And, you know, we tend to complicate the presence of God in our lives when all we would need to do is broaden our understanding of where God shows up. And this is, you know, one of the profound life lessons I learned in, you know, one of my trips to India. And I, you know, was initially planning on visiting various places in India in order to seek my own solace with God. But instead, God had other plans. Oh, I did see many places, but each time I came away blessed by the hidden surprises of simple blessings found in the most unlikely places, in and through the most unlikely people. For instance, when I was visiting a children's ashram, I went with the intention of being a blessing to them. You know, I took my flute. Okay. And that's the same flute that you hear at the beginning of these shows. You know, I said, I'm going to play for them. Okay. So one day I was planning on visiting three groups of children at an ashram. And I had my flute in hand. And like I said, I wanted to play a tune for each of them, a harmonious blessing, let's say, as it were. And at first, I was led to a group of 6 to 7, you know, year old boys and girls. They sat together and curiously watched this big guy take out his Native American flute and play for them. It was a simple tune, but a sound that they had never heard before, because they have the Bansuri. And their eyes and smiles widened as they listened to each melody come from a simple cedar flute. And when I finished, they clapped appreciatively and offered to sing a song for me. And as one of their requirements, they all needed to have memorized in the first 5 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita before they were a certain age. And through one of the house mothers, she offered to have them sing the first chapter to me. And the children sat there, cross-legged, hands folded, eyes closed, and they sang from their hearts. And the joy that filled that tiny room was indeed very, very precious. Well, the next group of the children I visited were the teenagers. I found them playing outside on the lawn, and when I approached them, they offered me a chair to sit down, and again, I played a simple tune for them. And, there it was kind of funny. Their toothy smiles illuminated their dark eyes as they listened carefully to each note, like they thoroughly enjoyed it. And again, after I finished playing, one of the girls, probably about 14, 15 years old, something like that, offered to sing two songs for me. And encouraged by her friends, she stood up and she sang a beautiful song, two songs in Hindi. Again, I didn't know the words, but when communicated from the heart, everyone there was blessed. And finally, I came to a small place that housed special needs children. And as I sat down, a big guy again with his flute, one of the children came and stood beside me. And I, as I played, I noticed the children stopped being agitated and they turned into just peaceful quiet in their hearts and in their minds. And I continued to play, and I started to hear one small boy who was blind from birth. He started to sing along with the soft, mellow tune. And as I stopped, he stopped. When I played again, he sang again. And it wasn't until later that I was told by one of the mothers that this boy was one who not only remained quiet for days, but that he had also never sung before. That day, my heart was made full by the simple gifts of children who came from their hearts and their soul. And on and on and on. This is how this trip was. God had certainly answered my prayer, not in terms of my expectations, but rather through the expansion of my understanding of what it means to see God every day. You want to see me? Ask God, then look for me in the invisible people, the misfits of society whom you pass by every day. People who seem to blend into the background and are never noticed because they're taken for granted or forgotten. See the invisible, and you will see me. You've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Thank you. Again, this is Dr. James Houck, and thank you for spending this hour with me. And again, it is my heart's desire that you come into the fullness of realization of who you are as souls, and that you begin to see one another as truly souls blessed by God. Take care. Good night.
For an answer, or just to leave a thousand comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.